Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Dr. Tayo Obafemi Ayeha, who is an assistant professor of electrical engineering at Missouri State University. Tayo, thank you for stopping by.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I know you've been here a little less than a year. Already you're bringing some of the work that you've done previously here. So could you talk about your broad research interests?
The core of my research is machine learning. And so specifically as it relates to biomedical applications. So I'm interested in developing algorithms and also in applying a combination of those algorithms, developing a framework that would work for the particular application. I don't know if you don't mind if I could just introduce machine learning.
Sure, that would be great because I don't really know very much about machine learning.
Well, machine learning is a very, very broad area, but it's just really talking about learning, a computer being able to learn and make predictions, from the data that it's presented, from the set of features. And so broadly, machine learning falls into three categories. You have the supervised learning, where I present data with labels, and then I let the machine learn from that. And then based on that, I feed in new data and I tell it to make a prediction as to where it will classify based on what it has learned. Presenting label data. That's what we call supervised learning. And then there's another area of machine learning that's called unsupervised learning. This is also known as clustering. So this is where I don't know the labels. So something like autism, that is so broad, it's heterogeneous, you don't have specific labels, or you just know that these kids are all been diagnosed with autism. In that kind of situation, your first line of defense is unsupervised learning, commonly known as clustering. And then the third area of machine learning is what we call reinforcement learning. So reinforcement learning is, I have some labels, I can train, and then I want to develop a cost function so that I can train better and also attack unlabeled data. So reinforcement learning is still a new and growing area. It's not so common. When people think of machine learning, they don't think of that. But we have these three broad categories.
So talk a little bit about, you did your machine learning presumably when you were in your graduate career, and then somehow you got this link to biomedical stuff. So talk a little bit about how that happened. How did you get drug into that?
Well, let me just step back a little bit. My undergrad is in electrical engineering. My master's is in electrical engineering. However, my PhD is in computer science because I had a professor that I really liked, and he was in the computer science department, though his background was electrical engineering, electrical and computer. And he encouraged me to come join, which is Dr. Ophir Frieder. He encouraged me to come do my PhD with him. And so my concern was, well, if I'm going to go into computer science, I want to do an area related to math, that had more of the algorithms, because that was what I was interested in. I didn't just want something pure software engineering or coding. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense.
So that was how I got involved with machine learning, because of all the algorithm and all the math involved. And specifically, my area of application during my PhD was for document image processing.
Right. So document image processing. Like what specifically? Counterfeit money or something?
No. We actually did historical documents. So documents related to the Nazi, documents related to documents that were archived in Washington, D.C. So we actually, very old documents. Remember the days, I don't know if you remember, Dave, you're probably really young, the days of using the typewriter.
Oh, no, I'm not that young.
You think about
I use the slide rule, so I'm not that young.
You think about the Constitution.
Sure.
1776?
1791 for the Constitution.
Okay. What was it written in?
What was it written in?
Yes.
Some sort of parchment of some kind or another.
But these documents are important to our society, right? And so dealing with how we converse and enhance those documents. So that's where document image processing comes in. And so we applied algorithms that could learn and then train, because, you want to automate things to make life easier for us using the computers. So that's how I got involved with machine learning in document image processing. And then after my PhD, we moved here in Lebanon, Missouri. My husband is a physician, and I wanted to be involved in an area that was related more to medical stuff, just so that, we could move along together.
Right. That makes sense. Okay. So the medical thing makes sense. So then you started working with some people at Mizzou. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. So I started working with Dr. Ye Duan at University of Missouri in Columbia. And Dr. Ye Duan is actually a computer graphics guy, but very intelligent. And the thing I love is the interdisciplinary nature of the research. And so he knew I was coming in from machine learning, and he had done some work on the brain images of autistic kids with Thompson Center for Autism at University of Missouri. And they were about to start doing the facial features analysis. And that was how he got me in to apply, the machine learning techniques that I'd learned from my PhD to a new area.
So let's talk a little bit about that study. So now you've got a study where you've got a number of children who are defined or diagnosed as autism.
Yes.
We already know that the clinical diagnostic characteristics for that have changed over the last several years.
Yes.
And so you've got essentially a continuum now of some sort of range, and and they're trying to get away from labeling within that range, I know, as far as things like Asperger's and things like that. So you've got that, and now you're going to have each of these kids. And what are they going to do? They're going to sit in front of a video camera. Talk a little bit about what actually transpires.
So we have their 3D image scan. So they had to sit in front of a 3D camera.
Okay.
So kids between the ages of 4 and 17 that have been diagnosed with autism, and then we also had the control kids. That's kids that have not been diagnosed with autism.
Right.
We took their pictures. And so now so the initial work that was done on this was actually done by Dr. Chris Aldridge. She's a professor of anatomy at the University of Missouri in Columbia. And so she had she just basically took the images and trying to apply what we call Farkas facial landmarks. So this is known in anatomy and anthropology that define the face,
right.
So we fed this data in. So we represent each image in our computer based on the Farkas facial features.
Right.
And so then what we were looking at was looking at the geodesic distance surface distance. Right. And so we feed it between. So we have like 19 landmark points. So the features were peer distances between this 19 points. So that comes out to be about 171.
Okay.
Or so, I can't remember off the top of my head, but roughly around that. Right. And so now we feed this into the computer.
Now, do you do that while the kids are undergoing a range of stimuli? In other words, I could see where some people might say, okay, now what we're going to do is try to evoke certain kinds of facial structures and features by asking them questions or trying to make them read, or how did that work?
No, so we didn't want any stimuli. So it was kind of hard because sometimes it was hard to get the kids to stay still.
Right, okay. So you just want a passive face.
Exactly.
And you want to look at this passive face, and then you basically have landmarks. Are the landmarks identified by the computer, or did you actually have people that actually look at it and click on the landmarks?
We had people trained to click on the landmarks, and we had to do the error verification and all of that with the landmarks.
And so now you give this data to the computer, and you say, unsupervised learn? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so we say cluster these features.
Okay, right.
And so another thing that you have to think about is, well, one of the questions that will probably come up is, what was your sample? Because you're talking about 171 features per patient,
right?
Well, we had a sample of 62 patients. And so one of the things you want to worry about, we're concerned about, is making sure that we're not overfitting the algorithm.
Right.
So one of the things we always had to do was feature selection. So we had to have our algorithm do feature selections, that's pick out features that were discriminant, so that there's no redundancy, And so we had all of that in, and, we applied different. And then one of the things that is always needed is also cluster validation, right? How do we know that these clusters are the ideal, the optimal, I'll put it, not ideal,
sure,
configuration. So we did all of that, and the work was published in Developmental Disorders, JADD. And so after we came up with what we thought was the optimal configuration, the optimal subgroups, then we reached out back to our clinicians, our collaborators from the Thompson Center, and we said, hey, Now give us the clinical data. Give us the...
Oh, so you did this blinded.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, at that point, until we were sure, they did not release any clinical behavioral phenotypes. We didn't have that information. Now, some could argue, well, that could have helped us out. Well, true, but they were interested in finding physical biomarkers.
So you're basically trying to cluster the faces and not worry about what's clustering them. And then after the fact, say, isn't this interesting?
Yes.
They cluster and there are clinical details that correlate.
Exactly. To say, okay, well, this is interesting, but is it meaningful? And so to determine if it's meaningful, then we look at the clinical data, we look at their behavioral data, you know. And so when we looked at the clinical and behavioral data, then we also looked at what we call genetic indicators, in sense of we looked at the information regarding their parents. Now, let me step back for a second. This, our data was mainly simplex. Simplex means that these kids were the only one in their family, in their immediate family, diagnosed with autism. So their siblings did not have autism, as opposed to a multiplex data sets where more than one in the family could have autism. So it was interesting to look at the parents in terms of their broad autism phenotype traits.
Right.
BAPQ. Did I get a BAPQ? Yes, you know. And so it was interesting because, and then we also looked at alcoholism. Though for this, you know, the reviewers were very particular about the definition of the alcoholism. But we did find out that there was some slight correlation. So that was interesting, but all of that is in the paper,
right.
You know. But what was most interesting for us was to see that the group that was the most compact, the most separate from the other groups with facial features, was the group that stood out the most as being very regressive.
Now, what does that mean when you say regressive? They can't they can't get better, so to speak, or
regression in terms of language regression.
Oh, okay.
Okay, kids that you know. Regression is a quantitative measure used for autism kids. You want, you know, some parents say, okay, well, my kid's still learning this, and then all of a sudden, at 3 years old or 4 years old, it disappeared. You know, they could speak something, but then they couldn't.
Okay.
You know, so regressed, you know.
So most people would think that would be far along on the spectrum, so to speak.
Yeah, so they'll be
at least with certain skills. They would have regression, and that would be, most people would characterize that as their autism would be severe or something.
Yes,
like
exactly.
And so they were in their own separate subclass, so to speak?
Yes, they were in their own separate subgroup. You know, this group, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think they were like a group of 13 or 17 out of the 62,
right.
You know. I think it was probably closer to
that. When you do something like that and the machine is learned and it's clustered,
yes.
What about it? I know it's got all these distances from between these markers already identified. Does it know, okay, it's this particular distance, it's this particular thing that is the clear thing that pushes this out into its own group?
Yes. So that's one of the things we're interested in when we do the feature analysis. So feature selection, we want to look at which features were most discriminative that stood out the most to the algorithm. And what does this look like? So we kind of try to think of an average face for the subgroup. And so we put that in the paper. I would be incorrect in what I say now because I don't have it accurately. But for the clinicians, that was very important for them as to whether they were characterized by a broad face, midline face, you know, all of that. But I would ask the listeners, if they don't mind, to look at the paper. We could put a link to the paper on there. But we were interested in that, you know, because for the clinicians were interested in knowing that these features meaningful.
Because they're thinking about, I'm not going to be able to get somebody in front of a 3D camera and then run this through the machine program to make sure that this is true.
Yes.
They're looking for things that they can identify as clustering, identifying marks.
Exactly. And so we presented that. And, you know, another thing is that 3D cameras are becoming a little more common for the hospitals, you know, dealing with this kind of patients. So they're trying to encourage, say, hey, if you can use the camera to take pictures, because the more data we have, the better, you know. And just to step back, just to digress a little bit, you know, another area that we've been studying is dealing with cognitive aging. But, you know, I'm working with, our team is working with Dr. Rob Paul from Missouri Institute of Mental Health. And the data that we're working on right now, one of the things he's interested in is what are the features that, you know, we're looking at, we clustered features of the brain. you know, measurements from the brain. And one of the things he's looking at, what features stood out to your computer? What features stood out to your algorithm?
When you say measurements of the brain, you mean MRIs? Is that what
you're
talking
about? Well, we mean MRIs and DTIs. So they came up with this new method, you know, to measure the distances of the fiber bundles in the brain.
Oh, okay.
So volumetric and then distances, weighted distances. So anyway, I say that to say this is some things that clinicians are always interested in. They don't care to know so much what your algorithm did.
Right.
But what surfaced has been distinct.
So now let's talk a little bit about you going forward with this. You're still going to work on this. Talk a little bit about the projects you're going to do here over the next few years, hopefully, and how students will be involved, things like that.
So I actually just came back from a conference in Hawaii where we presented a paper on applying graph clustering algorithms on autism phenotypes. So this was in collaboration with my colleague from Southern University of Illinois in Edwardsville. And my students that started out with me, Tay Nguyen from Computer Science Department of Missouri State, thanks to Dean Tammy Yankee, I was able to hire him in my lab last semester. He was a co-author on that paper. I would not have gotten that paper out and presented if he had not been in my lab. So we are continuing work. We are targeting a conference that the deadline is due in 2 weeks. I have two other students with me in my lab. I have Jeff Dale from Computer Science Department, and also I have Jesse Stewart from Computer Science Department. But one of the main things I'm interested in going forward is cluster validation analysis. Okay, Dave, whenever I'm doing my work, I don't have the clinical and behavioral stuff in front of me to validate my method. I have to mathematically validate my method.
Right.
And what we rely on, especially with clustering, is what's called internal cluster validation metrics. They're not perfect. And they're not ideal. And they've led us on some wrong tracks. But, you know, and so what we've been working on this semester is just analyzing different known data sets that we've drawn from UCI Machine Learning Repository and seeing that, you know what, there's an issue here. And we're developing a framework because if we can get a hand of that, that would help the biomedical stuff that we're doing, because then we can present more reliable and more meaningful and more hopefully significant.
So let me capture that if I can. So what you're saying is the techniques you have can be applied to biomedical, but you're going back and also doing work to make sure that the validity of the technique in general is shored up under certain circumstances.
Exactly.
Shored up so that you can rely on it and more definitively say things when you apply it.
Exactly. Because this is very important for us because, you know, you do an algorithm, you're very parameters, you get so many results. How do you know which one is optimal? The clinicians don't care for you to sort through your 100 top configuration. So that's important. We're also doing stuff with the genetic analysis. We are working on, we have a publication, a journal publication that we are trying to get out. We just got some feedback from the reviewers, so we're working on revising that. This work is also in conjunction with some of my collaborators from S&T because, you know, that's where I did my second postdoc. So I have Dr. Gayla Aubrey from the statistics department in Rolla with me on this project, and Dr. Donald Wunsch, who was my advisor while I was at Missouri S&T. So for me, it's critical to maintain these collaborations and also forging new collaborations. So I have new collaborations also developing with other faculty at University of Missouri. So I see my research going forward at Missouri State University, you know, strengthening my, across university collaborations, but also within Missouri State, I want to develop interdepartmental collaborations. I'm interested in data. I'm interested in data analytics. I did win an internal faculty grant for analyzing grapevine gene expression data with Dr. Wing-Peng Q from School of Agriculture. So Jeff Dale, my student, is working with me on that. We have a publication hopefully coming up soon. So, I mean, it's really interesting. I think I'm stretching myself a little thin.
No, that's fine. So what you're saying is data, machine learning, put together can weigh in on a lot of topics.
Exactly.
As long as there's data that can somehow be categorized and clustered in some way, shape, or form, then it could be applied to grapevines or autism or the arrangement
cognitive
of
aging.
Any number of other things.
Yes, any number of other things. And so even physics.
Sure, absolutely. We would never say that you couldn't be involved in that. You know, I really appreciate you stopping by, Tayo. Thanks very much for stopping by and talking to us on STEM Spots.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And this is Dave Cornielsen for a webcast version of STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.